This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
A day after a federal mask mandate is lifted, mixed reactions and some confusion on public transit, how it's playing out across the nation. And as world finance ministers are meeting in Washington this week,
Secretary Yellen has made clear that she wants to encourage countries that have so far remained kind of non-aligned or have not necessarily denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine in an attempt to kind of make clear to them the benefits of siding with the U.S.
Why that's going to be a tough challenge for U.S. officials. Plus, how a years-long battle over winemaking is spilling out into the hills of Napa Valley. It's Tuesday, April 19th. I'm Anne Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. There are mixed reactions on public transportation today as people across the country adjust to the first full day of travel without a federal mask mandate in more than a year. A Florida judge suddenly tossed the mandate yesterday, and the Transportation Security Administration said it would stop enforcing it. Major U.S. airlines said they would, too, on domestic flights. Our travel reporter Allison Poley took to the skies to see how air travelers are feeling.
I started in JFK, which is still requiring masks for travelers, even though they are not required to wear them on the actual flights. Then I came to Orlando, where about half of passengers are wearing masks, half are not. Some passengers I've spoke to are really relieved the mandate is gone. They might be traveling with young kids and said it's hard for them to keep it on. Others are pretty concerned and say they feel like it's too soon. Cases are going up because of the Omicron subvariant. And others are worried about immunocompromised family members.
The Biden administration is considering its next steps. White House reporter Ken Thomas says it's a tricky call.
If they were to appeal and fail, it might be more difficult for the administration to reimpose mask-wearing requirements if the nation is struck with another big wave of COVID-19 infections and deaths. There's also just a legal calculus here. Any kind of appeal would go to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, and that has a majority of judges appointed by Republican presidents. Conservative judges have generally been more skeptical of some of these steps that the Biden administration has taken in terms of mandates on COVID-19. And so you could see the risks for the Biden administration if it were to pursue some kind of stay or some attempt to overturn this ruling.
While the mandate has been removed on the national level, cities and states are making their own calls. In New York City, mask mandates on the subway will remain in effect for now. In New Jersey, masks will no longer be required on NJ Transit. In Ukraine, officials are racing to evacuate remaining civilians from the eastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions as Russia begins a new military offensive in the area collectively known as the Donbas. Ukrainian officials are warning that anyone who stays behind could be trapped. Meanwhile, the United Nations reports that nearly 5 million refugees have fled the country since the war began. More than half of them have escaped to neighboring Poland. The Biden administration has unveiled a new plan to address student loan debt. Our national economics reporter Gabe Rubin says it involves overhauling an existing program aimed at helping low-income borrowers.
The Education Department is revamping its income-driven repayment plans, which would allow people to make a certain amount of payments based on whatever their income is, and within 20 to 25 years, qualify for debt forgiveness of whatever is left on their loans. This change would affect around 3.6 million people who have not had their payments counted towards income-driven repayment plans, and it could affect even more people if they decide to enroll in the program. But even the 3.6 million is nearly 10% of all student loan borrowers. And this fits into the Biden administration's larger sort of piecemeal approach to student debt forgiveness, which has aimed to revamp lots of the programs that are already in place for borrowers to make sure that they can make certain payments and know that they are going towards ultimate forgiveness instead of just seeing their interest balloon over time.
Earlier this month, the administration extended a pause on all federal student loan payments through August. The investment firm Blackstone has agreed to buy American Campus Communities, which owns student housing in college cities and towns across the U.S. The $13 billion deal is a bet that rents will go up as more college students return to campus. It's also Blackstone's biggest foray into the campus housing sector to date. The firm says student housing makes for an appealing investment since it isn't as vulnerable to economic downturns as other sectors. And Netflix lost 200,000 subscribers globally in the first quarter and expects to lose 2 million global subscribers this spring as it grapples with competition and password sharing. Netflix had expected to add fewer subscribers due to high-profile content like Bridgerton and The Adam Project being released near the end of the quarter. It's also contending with growing competition from Disney Plus, HBO Max, and Amazon's Prime Video. Coming up, global finance ministers are in Washington this week, what the U.S. priorities will be during the meetings, and what challenges lie ahead. That's after the break.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
Finance ministers from around the world are gathering in Washington this week for meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The meetings come at a challenging time for global leaders as the U.S. and its allies seek to punish Russia with sanctions for its invasion of Ukraine. That's causing a rift with some other members of the G20 nations. And it's putting U.S. officials, including Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in a tough spot as they seek to balance a pressure campaign on Russia with other global crises like food insecurity. Joining me now from the Capitol with more on this is Wall Street Journal economic policy reporter Andy Durin. Hi, Andy. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Andy, before we get into some of the specific challenges facing U.S. officials, can you talk a bit more about the overall atmosphere that's expected during these meetings, considering the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, so there are kind of two main dynamics that finance ministers from around the world will face when they arrive in Washington. On the one hand, you have the, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the, you know, huge sanctions campaign that a lot of Western countries and G7 allies have waged in response. And so there's this split among the U.S. and its allies and Europe and Japan and Canada. And, you know, there are 30 countries from around the world that have joined this effort. And then you have a lot of countries, obviously Russia is opposed to these sanctions because they're the ones being sanctioned. But you have countries that lean more towards Russia than they lean towards the United States. So that's obviously China is one of the main examples there. So you have this kind of growing split over this war in the international community. At the same time, you have these, you know, major global crises that all these officials are facing. So you have, you know, the war has led to a shortage of critical food supplies in a lot of countries. Both Ukraine and Russia are major exporters of wheat, for example, to a lot of the world, including in the Middle East and North Africa. You have, just the general impacts of the pandemic continue to be a problem in a lot of countries around the world. You have inflation, you have fuel shortages also impacted by the war. So you have this kind of growing large list of problems that in a lot of ways require, you know, significant global and international cooperation while at the same time having an international community that's kind of fraying in a way that it hasn't in recent history because of this war at the same time.
And I understand Yellen may actually boycott some of the meetings this week.
So Secretary Yellen has said that she will not participate in certain G20 meetings that include Russian representation or Russian officials. And so she's expected to walk out or leave or not attend at least some of the G20 meetings that are taking place on Wednesday. That just really shows the kind of difficulty of kind of holding Russia accountable and encouraging other countries to hold Russia accountable for the war in Ukraine, while the other obviously having conversations and making progress on these broader issues. If, you know, she will be leaving or not participating in meetings on some of these topics that she says that she thinks it's important for the international community to make progress on.
So these geopolitics are creating a tough environment for Secretary Yellen and U.S. officials. What can you tell us about their priorities for these meetings? Where will their focus be?
So Secretary Yellen has made clear that she wants to encourage countries that have so far remained kind of non-aligned or have not necessarily denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine. These are, you know, some major economies, including India, for example, Brazil, South Africa, are all kind of countries in this camp where they have not explicitly denounced Russia or joined the U.S. in its sanctions campaign against Russia. So she'll be meeting with some ministers and representatives from those countries in an attempt to kind of make clear to them that, you know, the benefits of siding with the U.S. generally in this conflict is greater than any benefits they might derive from working with Russia. That'll be one major priority. Another one is to just figure out what else can be done to directly help Ukraine, whether that's additional financial support for the country, which is obviously suffering a lot of serious economic consequences from the war, or, you know, further sanctions on Russia and helping Ukraine in that sense and the war effort in that sense. And then on top of all of that, there will be some of these discussions around food insecurity, climate change, some of these other kind of broader secondary issues that Secretary Yellen has said she wants to make progress on. But, you know, it's obviously there's a lot to manage in just a few short days to make progress on all those huge issues.
What would you say are the biggest challenges for U.S. officials in meeting their objectives this week?
Yeah, I mean, one is just trying to convince, you know, obviously some of these countries that the U.S. is hoping to kind of sway more towards the, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of Western tilt on in this conflict. You know, some of these countries have longstanding ties with Russia, economic or military ties with Russia. I mean, India is a good example of that, where they've long been kind of a defense partner with Russia. And, you know, they buy oil from Russia and they, you know, they've in recent weeks have increase some of their oil purchases under contract. And so when you have those kind of fundamental dynamics, you know, obviously trying to change or address that can be difficult in a few short days. And then, yeah, food insecurity is one that Secretary Yellen has really emphasized. But at the same time, you know, when Russia and Ukraine are such big sources of wheat and fertilizer and kind of key commodities like that, it's hard to, you can't, you know, grow wheat overnight to provide to some of these places. So what you can actually do about that, when it's really just a supply problem, is obviously limited. So we'll see how all of that pans out. But, you know, I'm not sure it's as if that some of these issues are going to be resolved in the next few days. But it's obviously just an indication of kind of the new environment and landscape that the U.S. has to navigate on the international stage.
That's Wall Street Journal economic policy reporter Andy Durin. Andy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, in one of the world's most famous wine regions, a two-decade-long dispute is coming to a head. In Napa Valley, California, nearly 70% of the farmland on the valley floor is already in vineyards. They also cover about 23,000 acres of the valley's hillsides, so there's not much room left for grapes to grow. But one family there is seeking permission to plant further up the hillside. Their plan has been met with resistance for years. Neighbors worry about a new vineyard using up precious water, and environmental groups say clearing the land of trees would be bad for climate change. A final decision from authorities is expected soon, but our San Francisco-based reporter Jim Carlton says the dispute is about more than just the land.
Basically, what's kind of at stake here is, kind of the future of the valley. Wine is a $10 billion a year industry in Napa County, and there's just this insatiable demand around the world for wine. It just keeps going up. It's the number one industry in Napa County. There's like tens of thousands of jobs. And so to kind of keep growing, the wine industry says we have to keep pushing into these hills. On the other side, though, are the environmental interests. So there's definitely strong feelings there. And, you know, we're going to see what's going to happen. But it's a very pivotal moment now in Napa Valley.
And that's what's news for this Tuesday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.